outside the state of Texas, and the sovereign will pay.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 030824, Catherine Taylor Brown and others versus Phillips Petroleum Company and others from Fort Bend County and the 14th Court of Appeals District. Justice Brister is not sitting in that case. Docket number 031129, In re Kellogg Brown and Root, and docket number 031200, Matagorda County Appraisal District versus Coastal Liquids Partners LP from Matagorda County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each argument, and we expect to conclude the arguments by noon. The court will take a brief recess between each argument. These proceedings are being recorded, and the parties may contact the clerk's office for a copy of today's arguments. There is currently one vacancy on the court, which we expect will be filled in the near future. The court is ready to hear argument in 030824, Catherine Ayler Bowden and others versus Phillips Petroleum Company and others.
May it please the court, Ms. Kawaja will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'm here before you today representing more than just the main petitioners and royalty owners. I'm here representing anybody that's going to be impacted by a class action in Texas, and anybody with an oil and gas lease in the state of Texas. What the court decides today with respect to class action law and oil and gas law is important to everybody, and it affects a number of different areas of law. We're asking the court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision in all ways and to affirm the trial court's class certification in all ways. In my brief time before the court, I would like to discuss two of the issues, namely the first two issues in our briefs. This addresses, first, the interaction between the transactional approach of res judicata in a class action. And the second issue I'd like to address is whether a statewide class action of royalty owners who are paid under a proceeds provision is maintainable as a class action. And I think under the court's precedent, it is. Because of time constraints, I'll rely on the briefs for our arguments related to the third and fourth issues, which address subclass 2 and subclass 3. That's the GRA subclass and the subclass related to percentage of proceeds. Now, turning to the first issue, factually, this case is pretty simple. There are three subclasses who have each been impacted and treated by Phillips in a different way. There are different affiliate transactions for each class. The trial court, in its certification order, limited the certification to the claims asserted in the case. They each alleged a single breach of contract claim. And the court stated, this class does not include claims by class members that are not based on the foregoing claims. In the appellate court, Phillips argued that this meant absent class members' claims that are not asserted would be barred by res judicata, and further, that because they are subjecting absent class members to res judicata, that they are inadequate class representatives.
Are you asking for a separate rule of law, res judicata, to apply to class actions as opposed to all other types of civil litigation?
No, Justice Wainwright, we are not. We are asking this court to apply the traditional rules of res judicata, the transactional approach. And when that is correctly applied to a class action, it means unasserted claims. If they're not subject to class-wide treatment, they will not be barred in later litigation.
But what you're calling unasserted claims are claims that have been brought in the lawsuit. They're just not included in the class certification, correct?
Actually, it's hard to know what they mean by unasserted claims because we're speculating.
What do you mean by that?
Well, anything that's not alleged in the lawsuit, we've alleged breach of contract. There may be other claims, maybe related to the contract, or maybe fraud claims or misrepresentation claims to specific royalty owners. But those are things for which we haven't yet discovered class-wide evidence. Our discovery to date reveals class-wide evidence and uniform conduct with respect to certain breaches. And here, the breaches of the duty to manage and administer the lease as a reasonably prudent operator. And part of that duty is to market the gas with diligence as a reasonably prudent operator. We have evidence of uniform conduct that has been breached.
In civil litigation, claims that are not brought in a lawsuit but could have been brought, after a final judgment in that litigation, they're going to be barred by res judicata. Why shouldn't that be the case with class litigation? You cited a statement in Beeson that Rule 42 is never meant to be an exception to the rules of res judicata. But the rest of that sentence continues, and it says, or to provide a risk-free method of litigation. I don't know that courts should, in fact, I believe courts should not determine or direct what claims should be brought by plaintiffs. But once plaintiffs decide which claims they want to bring, which claims they want to pursue, then are you suggesting they should get another bite at the apple based on claims that were not asserted but could have been brought, or claims that were not part of the class certification but could have been attempted to be included in the class certification?
No, Justice.
Sounds like your argument is one where we'll try a certain claim, see if it works on a class-wide basis. If not, we should have reserved the right to try another claim. And it sounds like several bites at the apple.
No, I think if a claim is subject to class-wide treatment and it could have been certified, then it should be subjected to res judicata. But it's premature to determine at this stage what's going to be precluded and what's not, because the class hasn't even gotten notice of what claims are even being litigated. In B3, in the LePray decision that just was issued months ago, this court was focusing on the distinction between a B2 class and a B3 class, which this case was under the old rule B4, which is now B3. An injunctive class doesn't require notice to be issued. The B3 damages class, like this case, has safeguards built into the rule. You have notice of the claims that are being litigated. You have the opportunity to object to that and also to participate. If you haven't got any of that, So there's due process. I mean, you can bar those claims that are not asserted. We're not asking for a second bite at the apple later if a claim should have been treated as a class action claim.
Well, is that a fact-based determination or a liability theory-based determination? Because it seems like your main complaint here is the affiliated transactions. So does that mean that all claims by class members complaining about affiliated transactions, whether based on fraud, breach of contract, any other legal theory, would then be barred?
Again, it's hard to speculate in a vacuum because we don't know if those kinds of claims later asserted would have had class-wide evidence. The decision of res judicata is...
Well, but if it's the same evidence as here, let's say this class stands, all three of these subclasses stand. It's based on class-wide evidence of the contracts. Let's say you lose. Then what would prevent you from, under your theory, coming back again under a fraud theory based on the same evidence? Because it's class-wide evidence.
If it can be established that the fraud claim is subject to class-wide proof.
Which you said it would be, because it would be the same proof as here.
Then the defendant would have the benefit of res judicata. But what I think the court's concern below was whether subjecting the res judicata, it took it one step further. Not only are the claims barred, but are you going to be an adequate class representative just because you're subjecting them to res judicata? And no court's ever held that. I mean, you are entitled, class representatives, that's what they do. They bind absent class members. And that's federal law, Texas law, all around. Every court of appeals has held that.
But a lawyer who gives up most of his client's claims may not be an adequate representative.
It's strategy. If the class is getting notice and due process is satisfied, why can't you be subjected to res judicata? That's what the United States Supreme Court says in Stevenson versus Dow, all the way back to Hansberry versus Lee.
Well, one reason might be they're a little less than 3,000 members in subclass one. Is that right?
Approximately. And maybe not all of them have active leases, but that's roughly the number we have.
So they could, it would be hard, but you could join them all individually in the same suit.
It would be complicated, but we could.
You could. And if you did, then all of their claims that they didn't bring would be barred.
True. If they were.
Why should the rule be different if it's a class?
It shouldn't be. But the caveat that I'm asking the court to put on is the qualification under the traditional approach is that you've got to have a claim that could have been subjected to class-wide conduct.
I understand your argument, but at the end of the day, in one situation where they're all joined, there's one rule. At the end of the day, when they're not joined and there's a class, there's another rule. Why?
I don't think I'm asking for another rule, Your Honor.
Well, the class member whose claims are barred or whose claims are not barred thinks he got a different rule.
Let me point you to another decision which didn't make it into the briefs. It just came to my attention over the weekend. It came out of the Dallas Court of Appeals earlier this year. It's called Grant Thornton versus SunTrust Bank, and if I could give you the site, it's 133 Southwest 3rd, 342. A petition for review was filed in that case, and the Dallas Court of Appeals probably has the most thorough discussion than any of the other Texas appellate courts on the issue. And they declined to decide whether a claim, an unasserted claim, was barred by res judicata. But they did state the following, and they affirmed a class certification. The court stated, the record here reflects that the trial court considered the adequacy of the class representatives in the context of claim splitting and authorized the class to proceed with safeguards designed to protect the absent class members whose non-certified claims may be affected by the outcome of class action. There's no problem with subjecting a class member to res judicata as long as due process is satisfied. And it could be a claim is certifiable and it's not asserted, and it should have been, but it's subject, its decision should be made in a later action when it's attacked by an absent class member, not by this court, not by the Court of Appeals, not by the trial court. And if you look at the federal rules of civil procedure, which this court often does, and you look at the advisory committee's notes on Rule 23, in 1966, they even made a comment that expressly reserved the right of a later court to decide whether an unasserted claim is precluded by res judicata.
I want to ask you about some of the classes. The subclass one, you make a point of saying that Phillips admitted that it sold all of the gas at the wells.
This is correct.
It seems to me that the inquiry is going to be what would a reasonably prudent marketer have done differently, or what price would it have received at the well. What is your evidence on that?
That it was sold at the well?
No. That the breach of the duty or the damages. In other words, it seems to me that if the sale is at the well under the proceeds clause, the test is what price would you, a reasonably prudent marketer, have received at that wellhead? And right. What is your evidence on that that's class-wide as opposed to well by well?
I think you're jumping to how we would calculate damages.
I'm talking about breach and damages. It seems to me you're going to have to show well by well that at this wellhead there was a breach, this wellhead there was a breach, and damages. So what's your evidence on both breach and damages wellhead by wellhead? How do you prove that class-wide?
We're talking about subclass one, which I've argued conflicts with the Hankins holding. And under Hankins, I think a class action for proceeds leaseholders is certifiable. The implied covenant to market that we've alleged that protects these royalties is meant to protect the royalty owners from self-dealing, and that's something this court has recognized several times, in Yezegir and later again in Anadarko. The evidence on the breach of the duty is that a reasonably prudent operator would not have entered into a long-term gas purchase contract with its affiliate for 15 years and pay royalties based on that inter-affiliate transaction. There's evidence in the record that other companies pay royalties on the price received from the third-party purchaser. There's also evidence that Phillips Petroleum Company, the lessee in this case, actually markets the gas in other areas of Texas, and they do exactly what we're asking them to do on behalf of this class, which is actively market the gas and pay them the royalties.
But you have to show that there would have been a difference. I mean, how do you do that on a class-wide basis as opposed to well by well? I mean,
there would be a difference because the affiliate is actually actively marketing the gas for these royalty owners in this subclass.
But at some point way down the line after it's been processed, da, 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 da. What's your proof to show that back at the wellhead where the proceeds leads provision kicks in, that there was a breach of the duty, that they could have gotten a better price at the wellhead?
There's testimony from one of the Phillips employees. I can't remember if it's from the affiliate specifically or Phillips Petroleum Company, the lessee, because we deposed a number of the corporate representatives from the subsidiaries. But the testimony was there's absolutely no reason why that Phillips Petroleum Company can't do what its affiliate does.
What's the evidence that they could have gotten a better price? And how do you prove that class-wise as opposed to well by well?
I think the fact that its affiliate, its subsidiary, is actively marketing the gas and getting a higher price, is that I think the transfer price is just an artificial number. It's just on the books. It's just being a transfer, and that's it. So that would be part of the proof that we would show breach of the duties and damages, that they could have gotten a higher price. It's not reasonably prudent for them to just enter into a long-term contract.
Well, how do you take that back to the well with transportation charges, any kind of special charges between the well and the point of delivery, that sort of thing? How do you, that's what I'm trying to get at. How do you prove that?
It can be accounted for. That's all stuff that is maintained. It's information that's maintained by Phillips. And we're saying the price that you received by the third-party purchaser, deduct that back if you have to. But the price that the third party pays for is what's paid, you know, in an independent transaction, is what they're entitled to a royalty on, not this artificial price that is paid by a subsidiary. When you admit you can actively do and you can do what your subsidiary does, and you actually do it in other parts of the state, why shouldn't you do that for this group of royalty owners? It's sort of, there's no real explanation for why they make a difference between these two groups of royalty owners. Other companies do the same thing. So the damages calculation, you would go back and deduct those things. I think under Hankins, the classes are viable. In subclass one, there are a number of holdings that were made to find predominance wasn't satisfied. Each of them are legal errors that need to be reversed. One was, the first one being that the duty owed to the royalty owners is a fact question, which is absurd under all of Texas law, all of this court's precedent. The duty is a question of law. It's never for the jury.
And I think you're right about that, but would it vary from lease agreement to lease agreement?
No, I don't think so.
Why not, if some of them are expressed and some of them are implied?
The duty is going to be consistent. The duty is to behave as a reasonably prudent operator and to market this gas with reasonable diligence.
Well, it seemed to me, as I was reading the brief, that it comes down to your argument that whether it's expressed or implied, it's going to be the same no matter what.
Precisely. And to date, as much as they've protested about there being different express duties to market, they have yet to come up with a lease that says we don't have to do this with reasonable diligence, that they have to do it with a higher standard or a lower standard, and they have yet to come up with anything that says we can self-deal. I mean, if you found something like that, I don't think it'd be enforceable. And the fact of the matter is all of these lease terms are consistent. They're just phrased in a different way, and they're stating the law. They're stating what the law really is. Behave as a reasonably prudent operator. It's not changing the terms in any way, and I haven't come up with one that did, and if it did, it's not part of the class.
Another question on race judicata. You agree that those principles apply to defendants and counterclaims too, correct?
That's correct.
Parker County versus Spindletop that you cite involved a class-wide counterclaim.
Correct.
Let's assume that it was not dismissed for service issues, technicalities. If Parker County had six defenses or counterclaims and decided to bring one and lost on it, and that case was over and done, could Parker County say, well, there are other unasserted defenses that I could have brought, and I now want to gin the lawsuit up again and try those defenses one at a time? Because I didn't assert them against the class and the initial lawsuit, and I wasn't sure if they were assertable class-wide. Why would, under your theory, under your approach, wouldn't Parker County be able to take that approach?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
How's that different from what you're arguing plaintiffs are able to do?
If they had the opportunity to assert those counterclaims and to litigate them and to present them as class-wide defenses, then they should have.
And why should not that same rule apply to the other side of the league?
If they
have the opportunity to present them, as you phrased it, and litigate them, shouldn't it apply regardless of which side of the V you're on?
It would, but I don't know what claims they're talking about that are certifiable. If they want to admit that these class, there are other claims out there that are amenable to class-wide treatment and they should be certified, let's go for it. But they're never going to do that. They don't even think these claims are certifiable, and they're breach of contract claims. This court over and again has indicated class actions are permissible in Texas. Certain kinds are not. Personal injury class actions, we know, just are not workable. But on the other end of the spectrum is a breach of contract class action. And that one generally is when you've got uniform contracts, uniform duties, and uniform conduct. There are numerous cases in Texas law where you may have some claims affirm certification and some reverse, and you Shine versus Farmer case is an example where you had some claims which are not subject to class-wide treatment, fraud misrepresentation, and when the plaintiffs tried to abandon those claims on appeal, this court declined to allow them to do so because there was a certification order and the court believed that the class may have been entitled to notice that those claims were being dismissed and abandoned.
Counsel, your time has expired. Are there further questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondents.
May it please the court. Let me first try to answer Justice Owen's question about subclass one. There is no evidence that they have that would show a class-wide variation in a marketing duty at the well. Here's what they say in their reply brief, and this, I think, frames a couple of issues. It also frames an answer to Justice Heck's question. The petitioners say the royalty owners simply seek to be paid royalties based upon the first arm's-length transaction, not an affiliate transaction. The affiliate transaction takes place in the field at the well. It's based on an index price. It's exactly the same contract that a non-affiliated company, Nippon Oil Company, has on the same wells. What they want to do is go to where Phillips Gas Marketing Company, the marketing affiliate, sells gas at the City of Garland, at the Sweeney Refinery, and at the tailgate of a plant that puts gas into the interstate pipeline, and peg that price as the proper sale price. That is the first arm's-length transaction, not an affiliate transaction. In the case of these leases, most of which are two-pronged royalty clauses, that immediately destroys the class because they've now moved away from a sale at the wells, which is why proceeds are the proper payment. And they've moved to the tailgate of the plant after the gas has been used in the manufacture of gasoline or other products, or a sale way off the lease, I mean clear across the state, and we're into a market value determination, which is clearly a situational-based determination under this court's decision in Middleton. So none of this works when you get right down to it, and I think that's what the 14th Court saw. Now, Justice Heck asked about the specific clauses. Over 80% of the leases in Fort Bend County have an express clause governing the marketing duty. The named plaintiff's leases have a peculiar kind of clause. This clause is frequent throughout this set of leases.
I had a question about that. You gave us one example of an express marketing clause, and it didn't seem to me it was all that different from what we have said is an implied covenant. Are there any marketing clauses that are different?
There are four different ones that we've identified. We didn't set them all out. They are set out in our brief in the Court of Appeals. But let me speak to that one that we did give you. If you look at the second part of that clause, it says that in no event shall the lessee be required to provide facilities other than the normal lease facilities, a separator, on-lease gathering, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, your duty to market requires you only to provide facilities on the lease. Their argument in this case is that Phillips should have carried out the same thing that its affiliate did. In other words, we should have built a plant. We should have built a cavern at the Sweeney Refinery. We should have built a pipeline all the way to Garland, Texas, from Fort Bend County, and marketed the gas actively like Phillips Gas Marketing Company did. That clause negates that duty. We have no obligation to build facilities off this lease under that clause. Whether we do under an implied covenant to market, I don't know. But we certainly don't under that clause. There are other clauses in the lease, in some of those contracts that say that, you know, as long as we get a contract that has a certain duration and has a provision for renegotiation and that is dependent upon some market index, then that satisfies the duty to market. We did that. So I don't think if you analyze that subclass number one, which I'm surprised that's the one they've picked on to talk about today, that one just doesn't hang together. You've got the duty that they're trying to enforce. And they didn't do this right until the very last day of the class certification hearing, is a composite duty. It's based on different express clauses and on the implied clause.
If all the clauses were the same?
If all the clauses were exactly the same, now that would be the situation, I suppose, if there were no express clauses.
Or all express clauses that were the same.
Were exactly the same.
So what
I think
you
at that point you get into the very situation that Justice Owen spoke of. If you're going to test whether an operator exercised its duties as a reasonably prudent operator, you have to look at all the facts and circumstances governing each exercise of that duty. For example, if a well is located a long distance away from another possible source, a prudent operator might tie on to whatever source is available. He might take a lower price if his gas is of a poor quality.
Where is the point of your sale?
The point of the sale at the current time, we say, in subclass one, is at the wells.
Oh, I'm sorry. Where do you sell? Where do you resell it to?
Phillips Grass Marketing sells it essentially during this class period of time in three places. It sold it to the city of Garland.
But where? Where's the point of resale?
At the inlet to the city of Garland's own distribution facility. It sold gas to the Phillips Petroleum Company refinery in Sweeney, Texas. And there, Phillips Gas Marketing maintained a cavern which permitted Phillips Gas Marketing to, Phillips.
So your resale to your affiliate and your affiliate's resale to the end user all occurs at the same point?
No.
Where does your resale to your affiliate occur?
The Phillips Petroleum sells to the affiliate in the field at the well.
So the resale to your affiliate also occurs at the wellhead.
Phillips, as producer, sells to Phillips Gas Marketing, the affiliate, from the wells in the field. Phillips Gas Marketing then takes the gas.
But my question is, where you say that from the standpoint of the sale, you sell the gas at the wellhead to your.
That's what we say. Yes.
Okay.
Now, what their argument is that's wrong. We don't really. They call that a transfer price. They say the gas is really sold the first time when it's sold to a non-affiliate.
And the first time your non-affiliate resells it is at the tailgate of the plant or at the city gate or
right.
Plant.
Many miles away from the field. After the gas has been processed or transported, substantial differences are stored to meet peaking demand.
Can you imagine any sort of ability to make the determination of whether affiliate sales are a sham or a fraud on a class-wide basis? Or breach any provision?
I think I wondered about that, and there's the challenge that if we're right, you can never have a class action.
Seems that way.
I don't think that's right. I think I do have a serious question as to whether you can have a big class action, a statewide class action that depends on a number of different marketing transactions. But if you had a field, a unit or a field where there were a number of wells, and all the gas were sold at the same time, perhaps on the same contract, and all the leases are the same, or there's some unitization where the obligation becomes uniform throughout the field, I think you could probably have. There are class actions like that.
But aren't you going to pretty much fail numerosity then?
They may not. I mean, you may, for example, Justice Heck mentioned there are 3,000 members in Class 1. There are 3,000 leases in Class 1. I mean, there may be 20 different people who have royalty interest in those leases. I mean, we may be talking 25,000 actual members in the class. I don't know. I mean, I don't think you're going to have, you're not going to have hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of people, but you certainly could have a substantial number of people. I mean, there are classes like that, some of the cases that they point out.
What if this were limited to a class where the leases were the same? It was a proceeds clause. It didn't have an express covenant or whatever they were. They were the same. And you all stipulated, as you do here, that the sales occurred at the wellhead, and everybody knew exactly what charges were backed out. So the only variable, and it wasn't the variable, the only constant here that's really an issue is what price you're getting from your affiliate. And the evidence was that the price you were getting from your affiliate was about 10% less than what an arm's length seller would have gotten.
There are circumstances. I'm not prepared to say that, we're trying to kill class actions dead as a doornail in the oil and gas field. I do think you could have a situation like that where the proof was right.
Is that their argument in this case? Assuming, again, that you got over the hurdle of the leases are the same, is that essentially their argument in this case? That you're selling at a lower profit to you so that your affiliate can take the higher profit?
That's their argument at a very high level. But it seems to me that their argument for practical purposes and the evidence they put in was that they want to be paid a price based on sales a long distance from the field. And you'd have to assume away then all the two-pronged leases, which is they put in.
But if you're, if the variables are all, if the constant in there, the constant that causes the damages is your margin of profit, and that's uniform across the sales, why wouldn't that be easily provable through a class action?
I think a class action could be derived on the right facts, and I think you would have to do, as you said, you would have to prove, which they have never done, that non-affiliated sales in the field, in the same vicinity, under the same marketing conditions, were higher. And, for example, in this record, we proved to the contrary throughout the state. I mean, this is a huge...
Well, what if you proved that your marketing affiliate was buying gas from you and other sources, and the price they paid you was 10%, consistently 10% less than what they paid?
You might... I mean, that would be a good...
Is there any evidence of that?
No. In fact, the evidence is directly to the contrary. The evidence is that this contract was negotiated by a non-affiliate, Nippon Gas Company, a subsidiary of the
Japanese. Is this just with regard to Class 1, Subclass 1?
Subclass 1. Okay. They negotiated the contract. The price is based on index prices, less 10 cents. The index prices are Houston Ship Channel index prices. This is not at the Houston Ship Channel, and this is raw gas at the wellhead.
But that goes to the merits.
That goes to the merits, but I'm trying to answer the question that if was there evidence in the record of that kind. There is no evidence in the record of that kind. In fact, the evidence is all to the contrary. The evidence is that a non-affiliated company owning 50% interest in the very same wells sold their gas to Phillips Gas Marketing Company on the same contract for the very same price. So the most comparable sale is exactly the same as this sale. So there's no evidence of what you asked about.
Let me ask you about the res judicata question. It strikes me that a large piece of that would be advisory. If you can help me with
okay,
that.
Okay, here's the way I think that should be looked at. I don't disagree that the res judicata effect of a judgment is to be determined in the next case. And that I think that's well-established law, and that's the argument they make. However, in determining whether the issue of adequacy is met at the time a class is certified, I think it is highly appropriate, as the Court of Appeals did here, to look to see what kind of res judicata risk the class representatives are willing to visit upon the heads of the absent class members.
Which, of course, begs the ultimate question when it does arise. I mean, really what the Court of Appeals is saying is just failure to consider what the ruling might be on the res judicata effect down the road is the analysis. And what strikes me about the Court of Appeals statement is that any claim that arguably is not appropriate for class certification that might be barred by res judicata automatically makes the class representative inadequate, and that just can't be.
Well, I don't know. I think you have to look at the nature of the case, but look at the nature of this case. This is a suit on a long-term continuing contract where there is a long-term relationship between royalty owners or landowners and the oil company. And if you are going to bring, and let's even narrow it more, let's just say that the gist of the complaint, which is the gist of the complaint throughout this, is that we didn't get paid enough royalty. On the very gas that was produced from the wells on my property from February 1995 to the present, so a certain package of gas, certain production. To narrow it as narrowly as I think we might narrow it, any claim that has to do with whether I got paid the right amount of royalty, once that question's been litigated, ought to be closed. Otherwise, you never have any closure to a ongoing transaction. We delivered, we produced gas, we paid the royalty.
Well, but...
And, go ahead. There may be a half a dozen different reasons why someone could theorize that we didn't pay the right amount of royalty. What the plaintiffs want to do in this case, well, I think what attracted the Court of Appeals' attention, was the plaintiffs want to litigate one theory as to why they didn't get enough royalty during that period of time on that very package of gas. And they don't want anything else barred. So they want to be able to come back after, say, they lose this theory in subclass one and say, well, now we think you didn't measure the gas correctly, which is a huge issue in the gas field out there. Did you measure the gas appropriately? and we don't think you did, and so now you didn't pay us enough royalty because you didn't measure the gas appropriately. The very same gas and the very same royalty payments. Our position, and I think a position of any defendant, is when you have a, and this to me is well-established law, where you have a contract and you're suing on a transaction under that contract. Once that's done, then all other breaches of that contract emerge into
the judgment. I understand, but again, I mean, there's a big issue about this, and it's really largely undecided. And so how can you just say that the class rep is inadequate based on an undecided question? I mean, I understand the concept of willingness to abandon claims, which, of course, presumes that, that the ultimate determination is that they are abandoned. But it seems like an awfully broad holding by the Court of Appeals that if you give up any potential, possible, conceivable claim, you're just inadequate.
There may be a continuum, but it seems to me that this holding is exactly right, because you pick one theory as to why there might not be enough royalty, and that's what you want to litigate.
Would your answer be different if this were an opt-in class, if the representative was trying to make it opt-in?
I think that raises an interesting question, which after LePre, you know, I've thought about a lot, and that is whether notice makes a difference here. And going along with that, if opt-in would make a difference, I think it would certainly make it better. But that sort of begs the question under Bernal that the class has to meet all the requirements of Rule 42 at the time the class is certified, not after notice is given, and not after the absent class members have exercised their rights to opt out or opt in. I mean, the class that's certified has to meet the requirements of Rule 42 right now when the certification order is entered. And you can't rely on what class members might do or might not do after they receive notice, and depending upon what the notice says and the choices they make to clean it up.
In examining the adequacy issue at the certification hearing, if it's determined that, you know, we're going to make this an opt-in class or an opt-out class, but the class notice or definition is going to say this is all there can ever be relating to price from this period forward, would that then satisfy adequacy?
You might. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what particular provision there would be, but it would seem to me that a class representative who came in and made all those proposals would look like that he or she has, in fact, thought about the issue that we're all wrestling with here. Your Honor said you don't think these issues are decided, and I agree there's a lot of scholarly writing and courts are writing about this. I mean, I think that in Shine, the court made the comment that a class that in order to be certified requires all the class members to give up something like consequential damages raises a significant issue of superiority. So I think that's the same issue. Yes, Your Honor.
The U.S. Supreme Court suggests that there can be a class action on alleging an employer's discrimination, and yet individual claims could be litigated. They're not barred by the resolution of that class. How is this different?
Well, I think that the causes of action there are very different. The Cooper case says that a claim that there is a systematic pattern of discrimination once tried and lost does not answer the question as to whether there was unlawful discrimination against one or two individuals. And those individuals have the right to come in because their cause of action is different. The elements of the cause of action are very different. I mean, it may very well be that they can prove complete cases of discrimination against themselves without being able to prove a pattern of discrimination within the company. So I think the causes of action, as explained in Cooper, are very different there. Here, the cause of action has got to come from the oil and gas lease. Now, whether it comes from an express or an implied covenant, it doesn't come from a statute. It doesn't come from a general rule of law. I mean, the push and pull in these royalty owner cases, and I think we've got a good example of it going here this morning.
Well, there are lots of issues. We could have severance tax issues. We have measurement issues. We could have all, you know, there, as you know, lots of issues that go into royalty. And are you saying that every issue that could be litigated about the royalty payments, if it were just me suing you, I would have to raise in that lawsuit for that time period?
Then class actions, then how can you have a class action in these cases at all, even under the unitization theory that you...
Well, I think that at that point, I mean, people have... I mean, you have to give notice, and people have to understand that anything they have, if anybody's got a claim that things are wrong, they need to investigate it, and they need to get it in the case, or they need to come in. I mean, one of the interesting issues here, which to me is a huge issue, is that is what happens to all these individualized issues. I mean, they're in the action. They may be carved out of the class, but it seems to me that you have to consider, I mean, I think the predominance test is testing the class issues versus the individual issues in the action. And I think what we've got going here and what the whole problem comes from is that plaintiff's lawyers in these class cases want to jettison individual issues not just out of the class but out of the action altogether.
Are you suggesting that in a case where claim splitting is occurring in order to attempt to certify a class, it's an intriguing idea that notice has to be given to most, to the class members, that there are certain claims they'll never be able to bring, and that needs to be some type of effective notice, because as
explicit.
We know, most members of a class don't know what's going on with the lawsuit.
That's right. I think you have to be very explicit, and then you get into the cases that say that if any absent class member in his right mind would opt out, then this is probably not a good class action because it is not a superior way of handling these issues. We would ask the court to affirm.
I have one quick question about class two, subclass two. You say you argue well it's ambiguous, da da da. I know you've moved for summary judgment on ambiguity and loss, but should an appellate court look at whether the provision is ambiguous or not in deciding whether to certify? For example, if we were to conclude that the clause is not ambiguous, should we take that into account in deciding whether the class should be certified?
I think then you'd just be saying that the Court of Appeals made an error of law. But what the Court of Appeals did, I think, was completely appropriate. They looked at the class plan and concluded that the trial judge...
What if they disagreed with the trial judge? That's my question. What if the Court of Appeals disagreed with the trial... They looked at the lease and said, this is not ambiguous. What should that be taken into account?
Then you are making a merits decision, it seems to me, on an interlocutory appeal, and I suppose you could bind the trial judge by doing that, but all you're really reviewing is what the trial judge did with respect to class certification. And, you know, you really, I don't know that the appellate court has before it at the time whether the trial judge was right or wrong on that question. Issue didn't come up.
But that my question was very similar as to subclass 2. If we were to find, and it seems, I mean, an argument can be made that the GRAs, whether or not they require proceeds on natural gas liquids, is ambiguous or not. If we were to determine that it's not ambiguous, and it does require it, or it can be determined based on the plain language of the contract, would that then be a certifiable class?
Not that subclass too, because the much more interesting issue in that class is the intra-class antagonism. I mean, that class completely dissolves into classes of winners and users. I like to capture that. That's the Lake Wobegon class, where all of the gas is above average in the plaintiff's view. And it's not. Some people are going to get less, and some people are going to get more. There is no conflicting evidence in the record on that subject matter. That is a matter of math.
But should we let the question, should we let all of that proceed on a class action ambiguity determination when at the outset, an appellate court says this isn't ambiguous?
Well, I would like to be able to bring up questions like that in class certification proceedings, but it does strike me, as the law currently exists, that you would be rendering a decision on the merits in the course of an interlocutory appeal on class certification. But, I mean, I've always maintained that this is not ambiguous. The other side clearly maintained in the trial court that it is ambiguous, and the trial judge said he's going to submit the question to the jury, which I think is what caught the Court of Appeals' attention.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to just respond to what was said about subclass 2, we didn't maintain that the GRAs were unambiguous. If you look at our pleadings, which are in the third
volume. Are unambiguous, sir?
No, we said they're, I'm sorry, we didn't say they were ambiguous. We said they were unambiguous. Thank you, Justice Eck. If you looked at volume 3 of the clerk's record, that's where our opposition to the motion for summary judgment is. And we simply said their interpretation is unreasonable. Trial court denied their summary judgment motion and presumably found their interpretation was not reasonable. It doesn't mean...
Well, then why is he going to submit it to the jury?
The question to the jury is... There's two questions.
What does it mean? That's the question.
Pardon me?
The question to the jury is, what does this mean?
Why would you ask that? It's not ambiguous.
The question is did Phillips breach its duties to the royalty owners? Not is it ambiguous, not what does it mean?
Well, it's either you calculate MCF or MMBTU. Which is it?
I think the way it's stated is if you think that they've breached the duty, then you include natural gas liquids in the formula, not necessarily asking them should it be an MCF or a BTU. The bigger question that he raises about the interclass antagonism doesn't exist either. He says there's no conflicting evidence in the record, and I beg to differ because there is. The evidence was conflicting. There was evidence that perhaps for 1 month that they showed in the record that one of the class representatives may have sustained a minimal loss. 1 month out of this now 10-year period.
You've got a volume of gas, and either the liquids are included or they're not. And some, I mean, doesn't it seems like they're going to be winners and losers, just like you said. I mean,
overall, though, they're probably all going to benefit because the gas, the quality of the gas is not going to be consistent necessarily from month to month. So there may be a fluctuation, but in the end, you're going to benefit overall from it. So they showed the trial court evidence of about 1 month for this particular class representative. The trial court has the discretion to decide the facts on conflicting evidence, and it did.
But to the extent one class member gets paid more here, that it necessarily takes away from another class member, doesn't it?
They didn't prove the conflict, Your Honor. It's speculation at best when you show just one
month. What's your theory? I'm asking you what your – there's just one pot of money, right? And the issue is how it's split up among royalty owners.
No. Let me start back at the beginning. I apologize if I'm confusing this. The gas is being delivered from Phillips Petroleum to GPM at a certain point. It's raw gas, and they're paying royalties right here on the raw gas. Then they're distributing, separating the gas from the liquids, and the subsidiary is selling the natural gas liquids and then the dry gas, and no royalties are being paid for the sale of the liquids, and that's very substantial. What we're saying is there should be a royalty on the dry gas and on the natural gas liquids, not on this.
But that's only if the payment is based on the transaction at the plant, right, as opposed to at the well.
That particular issue doesn't come into subclass 2, I don't think, Your Honor. This is because we're interpreting the lease language of the GRAs, which says you're entitled to royalties based on the sale of gas and components of natural gas. And so to people other than lessee. So when they're selling the natural gas liquids and the dry gas, natural gas liquids are undisputedly a component of gas. So we're entitled to royalty payments on the sale of natural gas liquids as well. So bringing me back to the whole point that some class members may receive more damages than others, but the fact that there may be different damage inquiries doesn't defeat class certification. It's not fatal. Third conflict is speculation at best, and it was within the trial court's discretion to resolve the fact issues in our favor. The Court of Appeals simply disagreed and disregarded the evidence in our favor that showed there would be a gain for class members. If it wasn't so profitable for Phillips, they wouldn't be arguing about this so hard. They're saying some people are going to be at a loss, and so let's just take it and nobody gets anything. That doesn't make any sense. So for all of these reasons, I see that my time is up. We ask the court to affirm the certification order and remand to the trial court.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.